case of the day, and I can say good afternoon. 10-3524, Schorsch versus Reliance Standard Life Insurance. And, okay. Mr. Larum. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Mr. Larum. Long time no see.
Long time no see, Judge.
Really?
I was in high school a year ahead of me.
No.
Just, what, a few years ago.
That should have disqualified him.
Let me tell the panel this. He was state champion in debate
really?
In 1967.
Wow. Congratulations.
Well, thank you, Judge.
Yeah.
My children refer to it as the good old days or the olden days.
The olden days.
We have a new system or a different system today in time. I will receive a card as to when the seven minutes are over.
You get the white one when you're going into your rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Norman Larum, and I represent Deborah Schorsch in this matter. ERISA imposes high standards on any insurance company that acts as a claims fiduciary. It is our position, it is my client's position, that Reliance should not prevail in this matter on the exhaustion doctrine, which is an equitable defense, because it did not adhere to the high standards imposed on it by the ERISA standard as a fiduciary. Instead, it played a game of gotcha or a game of hide the ball, and failed to comply with the ERISA statute and the federal regulations in the way it notified my client about the termination of her long-term disability benefit. Specifically, Reliance knew about and had in their possession a favorable vocational analysis, which was conducted by a professional here in the Chicago area.
Mr. Larum, of course, that goes to the merits. And we're here because of a determination that there was a failure to exhaust.
Well, it also goes to the procedure. I'm not trying to get into the merits. I'm going to the procedure, which is the federal regulation, which pertains to Section 503, which requires the termination letter to contain certain information that's easily understood by the participant, one being the specific reasons for the termination, another being an identification of materials that would enable the participant to perfect the claim or perhaps to aid the fiduciary in coming to a different resolution. So this is procedural.
The initial denial letter provided that the insured could request the documents on which the denial was based. Did George or her lawyer ever ask for those documents?
Well, I was her lawyer, Judge. And no, we didn't, because at the time, we believed this was a general denial based on her medical records. And at the time, we wanted to gather several years of medical records from her treaters in order to present those records to Reliance. We did not know that one of the reasons for the denial was a surveillance report that she was fully employed in a daycare operation, which is when true, and that they had a vocational report that was favorable to her that was conducted in March. So they withheld two material pieces of information that would have allowed her to respond immediately. The letter does not give her a fair opportunity to appeal because it withheld material information.
It did what?
It did not give her a fair opportunity, a reasonable opportunity to appeal.
Because?
Because it did not give her key material facts. It didn't tell her that one of the material reasons was that she was fully employed in a daycare operation on the basis of a surveillance report. Even though they sent that report to the IME doctor, they didn't mention it here, and they did not mention to her that there was a vocational analysis that was favorable to her. Instead, they say that her complete claim file was reviewed by her vote by our OUR vocational staff, and we've determined that you can work 15, 20 different jobs, which, as we did, as we learned in discovery, was simply not true.
Am I correct in assuming that you never asked your client if this was an employer-provided benefit rather than a privately purchased?
Oh no, I did, Judge. I absolutely did. That is,
you did.
That is not true. You know, in
because
the,
I'm trying to figure out why you just assumed it was government.
Well,
state insurance law.
Because there was no summary plan description given to her, there was no plan given to her. The only document given to her or me, and I handled her claim with Reliance since 1993, was a group policy that has no ERISA boilerplate language, that doesn't mention administrative appeal, that doesn't mention federal courts. You know, and I want to refer the court to a Department of Labor regulation 2510.3-1j, which provides that where an employer only facilitates payment of premiums for a voluntary group insurance program and no money comes back to the employer or the employer is not the plan sponsor, then that insurance falls outside the definition of employee welfare benefit plan. The information I had at the time was that she paid for the premiums. They took it out of her check, and that this is a small company, 200 employees, only a few opted into this voluntary program. She was the only claimant. The employer told me over and over again, we're not a part of this, it's all Reliance, it's between you and Reliance. And in 1993, when they submitted the initial claim form, I represented Ms. Schorsch with Reliance on the claim, and then in 1998, when the definition of disability shifted to a more stringent one, I was the one who represented her. I dealt with their people who came to my office and conducted a hearing. So in all that time, they talked about her in terms of being an insured of an insurance policy. Never once was this policy, this group policy, ever referred to as an employee welfare benefit plan. Never once was she or I given a document that had the boilerplate ERISA language in it. And the law, contrary to what Reliance now wants this court to believe, does not automatically put a voluntary group program under ERISA law, because my client paid premiums for this policy. And at the time, she was under the impression, and I was under the impression, that she was paying all or most of the premiums. And that would take it out of ERISA. And I was even given that advice in 2007 when I received their close the door letter in February of 2007. But the point is, from a procedural, and it's very important, procedural aspect, there was no boilerplate ERISA language in that termination letter. None. It talked about a request for review. It didn't use the word administrative appeal. It didn't say, if we turn you down, you can go to federal court. It withheld critical information as required by the federal regulations. A specific reason means a truthful reason. And they had the surveillance report that told them that she was fully employed. Isn't that a material reason? I mean, that's got to be the most compelling reason that any fiduciary would want to inquire. They didn't say, submit to us materials that will dispel this surveillance report, which was false, completely false. It was reasonable for me to conclude that this was not an ERISA plan at the time, given the facts that I had before me and given the facts that she had before her.
Thank you, Mr. Larum. Thank you. Hello, Ms. Bailey.
Hello. Hello, good afternoon, Your Honors.
So happy to see you.
I'm
because
blessed.
You're the caboose.
I know.
Oh, no. Mr. Lamb's going to be the caboose.
It is true. He will follow me. May it please the court, distinguished opposing counsel. My name is Edna Bailey. I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellee, Reliance Standard Life Insurance Company. And we respectfully submit that the facts of this case do not leave any question that plaintiff failed to exhaust her administrative remedies, and that as a result of that, she is barred, to pursue a claim for benefits in court.
Well, what is the administrative procedure? Where is it in the plan documents? And when were the plan documents provided to her, and where will we find the plan in the record?
We issued the policy, and that is the only document we have. In terms of the plan, given that we are not the plan administrator, we can't speak to that. And it is not my client's responsibility to provide the participants in the plan with any SPDs. That is the plan holder's or the plan administrator's responsibility. And we don't know why it wasn't done in this case or why Ms. Schorsch was unaware.
But your letter denying benefits didn't comply with federal regulations. You didn't list the relevant plan provisions on which the determination was based. And you gave only a partial explanation for the denial. And you might have stated an incorrect time limit for the appeal. So, you know, if we used a de novo review of your decision to strictly enforce the time limit, wouldn't we have to give the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt?
No, I disagree, Your Honor. We did cite to the relevant policy provisions that underlied our determination, and we cited the relevant evidence that our determination was made on. It was based on the results of an IME, which found that Ms. Schorsch was able to work, as well as a vocational assessment. That is what the determination was based on. It was not based on the surveillance, even though Mr. Larum seems to believe that it was.
The medical evaluation did make some reference to the surveillance.
One sentence. That is correct, Judge Tinder.
Yeah. But there seems to be some confusion in the record over who is the plan administrator, because the plaintiff says Reliance denied being the administrator below, and you deny on appeal being the plan administrator.
Correct, we're not.
If you weren't the administrator, if Reliance wasn't the administrator, how did it have the authority to deny the claim in the first place?
We're the claims administrator, the authority to...
Can you move back just a wee bit? I'm sorry, because it's...
Yes, it echoes.
Yeah,
we're the claims administrator, Your Honor, and we were delegated the authority to determine eligibility for benefits. However, the entire employee welfare benefits plan, which certainly does not consist only of a long-term disability benefit, but also of life benefits, of health benefits, were administered by the employer, by United Conveyor. And our policy does state that, and so did the SPD.
Will the record tell us when the administrative documents were lost?
Our understanding is that the record was lost in 2009.
But in other words, the denial letter informs her that she can ask for documents mm-hmm. underlying the decision. And if they were lost within 180 days, it would have been futile for her to ask for the documents and futile to require an administrative appeal.
They were not lost until 3 years later.
Until 3 years later.
The denial was in 2006,
yeah.
And the lawsuit wasn't filed until 2009. Once the lawsuit was filed, my client was attempting to locate the claim file to send it to us so we could produce it, and that effort did not result in the location of the claim file.
You know, that is disturbing, isn't it, that it was lost?
But it has nothing to do with the question as to whether in 2006 plaintiffs submitted an appeal or not. All she did after the denial, and she did it within the 60 days, which we submit is the proper time limit, given the fact that the 2002 regulations only apply to claims submitted after 2002. Her claim was submitted initially.
Well, it doesn't matter to you, does it, whether it was 60 days or 180?
No, she didn't appeal within 180 days either. Uh-huh. I'm just saying that our letter did not provide Ms. Schorsch with an incorrect time limit. Based on our understanding of the regs and based on several court decisions, we believe that that was the proper time limit. But in this case, Ms. Schorsch never appealed. She didn't appeal during the 60-day period. She didn't appeal during 180 days. She never appealed. And she did not seek immediate court redress after our determination to close the file either. She waited in excess of 2 years to finally involve the court with a lawsuit. So our position is that given the fact that she simply sent a letter saying she would gather documents and submit them by end of the month, which was in August of 2006, and my client didn't receive anything, not at the end of August, not in September, not in October, not until January, never, as a matter of fact. Plaintiff failed to exhaust her administrative remedies, and as a result of that, the claim is properly denied, and she is barred. While I understand plaintiff's desire to attempt to point everything under the sun out to the court in an effort to make our determination seem unfair, that is simply not what happened here. What happened here is that this was a clear termination of benefits based on the results of an IME and a vocational analysis. The fact that we couldn't necessarily re-piece together who rendered that determination doesn't make it false. And plaintiff's conjecture that we lied is simply not supported by the evidence, Your Honor, and it does not excuse plaintiff's behavior to not submit an appeal in 2006. She could have submitted medical evidence, and as a matter of fact, she should have submitted evidence. Our letter to plaintiff stated very clearly that our decision was based on the medical evidence in plaintiff's file. As a matter of fact, it states, our determination regarding whether you meet your group policy's definition of disability is and must be based on the medical documentation in your claim file. We have no basis on which to measure subjective complaints or medical opinions, and that is added given the fact that plaintiff's case is a pain case. That are not substantiated by the medical findings. We must determine if the medical information documents the presence of a physical or mental condition limiting your ability to perform your own or regular occupation. That is the wording of the denial letter. And the denial letter refers to the IME report, which also states very clearly, based on the physical examination of plaintiff, that there is no functional impairment based on the examination, that there are no significant limitations or restrictions. As a result of the findings of Dr. Tittle on IME, my client terminated benefits. There was surveillance. That is correct. Whether the surveillance is proper or improper is not exactly before the court, and whether the surveillance results do not lead to the conclusion that Ms. George was employed or not, I'm not contesting either. It's not before the court either. The question before the court is whether it was proper for plaintiff to simply blow off the deadline, to simply not appeal within the 60 days that were provided. And I submit also that my client relying standard provided very detailed description as to what to do. Reliance stated, you may request a review of this denial by writing to. A specific address was provided. It said the written request for review must be sent within 60 days of receipt of this letter and state the reasons why you feel the claim should not have been denied. There is no reason why there's anything in our denial letter that would have stopped plaintiff from simply submitting a reasoned analysis as to why she was disabled. This is a policy which provides benefits for disability. She had the provisions that we relied on, and she had our rationale. There is simply no argument to be made that whether we would have stated A and B or A, B, and C as our reasons, either one of those variants would have provided plaintiff with a better or worse opportunity to appeal. It was her position, and it seems to persistently be her position, that she is disabled and entitled to benefits. She was provided by us with an explanation as to what the basis is of our decision. She could have rebutted this, but she chose not to. She said she would provide an analysis, and she did not. We waited 180 days. She did not provide anything. When we sent her a letter in January of 2007, I believe, in February of 2007, informing her that we had not received anything and at this point we would close the claim, she responded in April, another 2 months later, saying that the delay in following up on my August 3, 2006 correspondence was due mostly to my trial schedule. She did not say that she was unable to respond to our reasoning in our letter. She simply decided not to appeal, or she forgot to appeal. In any event, that is not something that can be excused by the allegations that plaintiff is raising in this appeal and has raised in opposition to our motion for summary judgment. As such, we submit that Judge Gettleman's decision is correct in this case and should be affirmed. Another point I would like to make is plaintiffs submitted that the payment of premiums by an employee takes an employee welfare benefit program out of ERISA. That is incorrect. The safe harbor provision, which allows the taking of a program out of ERISA, consists out of five different points. Each one of those has to be fulfilled in order to have an employee benefit program not be governed by ERISA. The voluntariness of the program slash the payment of the premiums by the plaintiff, either fully or partially, is just one of those factors. I am sorry, Your
Honor. No, that's fine. Thank you.
And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Two minutes. Just a few points in rebuttal. Reliance is the fiduciary. I am not a fiduciary. My client's not a fiduciary. Reliance is the obligation to be truthful. They were not truthful. Their rationale was given, yes, but the rationale was based on false information and omitted material information that was favorable to my client, a favorable vocational analysis. The discovery here revealed that the vocational analysis, which they talk about in their letter, just didn't happen. It didn't happen. And the man they identified as doing it denied that he did it. That's critical because this letter led my client and me on a wild goose chase trying to amass 4 or 5 years of medical records in order to put together a response to this.
It's really hard for me to understand that it led you on anything. It told you the denial letter or termination letter says 60 days.
Right. It doesn't tell me.
So you can get a copy of what we relied on and so forth.
That's Judge, it's all true.
And then nothing happens.
Well, it does.
Except for this slight letter.
No, I sent a letter, and the letter says we're going to get the medical records and we're going to give it to you.
And
my client is a woman whom they know is cognitively impaired with her medications and with her disability.
Well represented.
Right. Well, she is, and that I'm busy, she's busy, 60 days pass, we don't have it. There's nothing telling me that this is a mandatory procedure.
120 days passes and on.
Because the 60 days are gone, and that's all they say I have. They don't tell me that I have 180 days. They don't do that. They have an obligation to comply with the law. They are the fiduciary.
When did you get the wrong? When did with the last correspondence? I mean, it seems to be continuing. I don't remember the dates that she read. The last letters. What? It seems to me there's still some kind of a delay before even filing a lawsuit. I don't have those in front of me.
But we were within the statute of limitations. There was a delay. This is a red herring. We filed within the applicable ERISA statute. And whatever, if there was a contract claim, there's no problem with the statute of limitations. We filed timely the complaint in state court. So that's not an issue. But one further point, please. In equity, and in the new regulation, the 2002 regulation, if an ERISA fiduciary has unclean hands and did not comply with the law, then the claimant is deemed to have exhausted her remedies, and that equitable defense should not be available to an unclean hands fiduciary. And that's what we have here. And that's the procedural issue that's so important here. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Larum. Thank you, Ms. Bailey. The case is going to be taken under advisement. This court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30. And thanks to everyone.
That button in the top.